I have to say, special edition, a Memorial Day weekend edition of the Callahan Podcast. And today we talk to Buck Sexton of the Buck Sexton Show, radio guy, podcaster. He's only 38, I believe, but he's got a great, interesting resume. He's been in the CIA. He's been with the NYPD. He worked at CNN. We're going to talk to him about that. We're going to ask him about who's the biggest a-holes at CNN. And he's been on the Bill Maher show a couple times. I want to hear some inside stuff about Bill Maher. We'll get into all that with Buck Sexton on today's special edition of the Callahan Podcast.
This is the Jerry Callahan Podcast.
All right, joining us now is Buck Sexton. Buck Sexton of the Buck Sexton Show, Buck Sexton Podcast, BuckSexton.com. I'd do that too. If I had a cool name like Buck Sexton, I'd name everything after me. But what's going on, Buck?
Oh, Jerry, thanks so much for having me. And you know, it's funny. It's actually my middle name. My parents, you know, I'm a child of the 80s, and you know, people thought that it was cool to have a middle name that they would call you as your first name. But why not just make it your first name? I've never gotten an answer for that one. So there you go.
Really?
Yeah. My parents are just like, we thought this was what happens.
Well, it works. I listen to your podcast all the time. I know you're a New York guy. I see you now sitting. You're in the belly of the beast in the middle of the hottest of hot spots. We're in Boston. We're both shut down. We both have, you know, crazy mayors and governors who are never going to, you know, wake up and open things up. But when you're sitting there, do you feel like, okay, we got enough evidence. We've looked around the country. We know what's happening in Florida. We know what's happening in Georgia. Time to wake up here. Do you think there's hope for a place like New York City or Boston for that matter?
Yeah, Jerry, I'm in Midtown Manhattan. I mean, I live and work, or formerly worked in Tribeca, but I also do a lot of work in Midtown. And this is the only place, at least as I checked the stats recently, and the five boroughs, pretty much right where I am is where they had a real surge of cases that reached the same level as the worst areas of the five boroughs out in the Bronx and Queens, Midtown, because of the subway system here. You got a lot of people coming through that unfortunately got the virus. I think that now finally the data is showing what a lot of us had assumed all along, which is that the lockdowns are far more of a speculative maneuver than they were actually based in science, and really a panic maneuver. There's really no way you can look at the switch from 15 days to slow the spread, which is what we had as the initial mantra, I mean, nationwide, to now it's two months to make sure everybody's safe and no one faces the virus. Problem with that is that that's also impossible. I mean, when you go outside your home, the virus will be there. What's really pushing this along is the economic devastation is becoming so extreme that I think, Jerry, it's starting to push people to the point where they're just going to non-comply. They're going to say, I've had enough, and they're going to start going about their lives.
I think I was just saying that today, that eventually the people are going to open things up again. You know, our government, our governors, our mayors, they're going to be hesitant. Some of them, I think, are waiting for November 3rd. That's the goal. Wait for the election. And people are just going to say, screw it, and open things up. You can see it right now with many more cars on the road, people on the road. I think people, more and more people are getting fed up. Unfortunately for you and me, we're going to be in the last, you know, the last bastions of.
Can I ask, is your mayor as crazy? Because I always say that Mayor Bill de Blasio is, I put him up there in like the champions tournament of the worst mayors ever. I feel like he might be the ringer. I feel like nobody can really line up to de Blasio for a major city. Is yours almost as bad as ours?
I think you win that one. You win that one. De Blasio is worst. He's dumber. And I don't think our mayor seems like a nice guy. He's just misguided. He's a liberal and he's, you know, never going to say, let's just open it up. He wants to be cautious. He wants to appear compassionate. Your guy is threatening to go in the water and get people out who are swimming.
I mean, promise to get them. He says he's going to go in there and pull them out if they have too much fun in the water. Absolutely.
I'm trying to keep this straight. Is he going to get everyone out of the water or just Jewish people? Because I'm never quite sure with de Blasio.
Look, he has tweeted about group gatherings that have always been about members of the Hasidic community and no other community. And people are starting to ask questions, that I can say. Like, what's that all about, de Blasio?
And I want to get to your governor, too, because this drives me nuts. I know And he's kind of a national figure. And early on, he was a star. And I always say he thinks he was Bruce on Broadway. He thinks he was doing this riveting monologue about his life every day. And at first, it was working. People were swept up and they were enthralled, and all the networks or all the cable stations were covering it. Then came that decision he made on, what was it, March 25th. March 25th, that order to send coronavirus positive patients into nursing homes. And we know what happened next. Total carnage. I mean, thousands and thousands dead. I can't think of a bigger, you know, more deadly scandal involving a governor. And yet there he is, still in front of the cameras every day, giggling with his brother about how his, you know, how he's a single guy and he's got a big nose or whatever. They're joking about something every day. It seems like a real disconnect that the grievous harm he's caused with his, you know, this public persona. Does it feel that way there in New York? Like he's just getting away with stuff?
Yeah, it feels like we see the results now, whereas before we were just seeing a lot of the PR from the Cuomo administration. And he was holding these press conferences. And at first, I will say, because he was, and I, you know, I have a bit of a mea culpa on this one, because I was like, all right, at least he's not being overtly political in the early stages, not making everything about Trump. You know, the governor Inslee out in Washington State was just being a loon, you know, complaining about, and this was in the worst weeks of it, you know, complaining that the administration had Pence call him and not the, he's just being a wacko. So I said, okay, Cuomo's doing a decent job in the early stages with the press conference, but we didn't have any numbers. We didn't know what the decisions were actually going to turn out to be and how it was all going to shake out. I mean, now you mentioned we got over 5,000 dead in nursing homes alone in New York State. And we have to remember that nursing homes should have been step one. The very first thing that should have happened based on the data. We keep getting lectured about science and data. Where did this hit first, Jerry? As you know, Washington State was the first time we saw it on U.S. soil where there were a lot of people dying and people started to get really scared of what was going to happen. But that was also in keeping with the data out of northern Italy, in Lombardy and these other areas. The overwhelming age demo that was dying in northern Italy was over 70. Really, a lot of it was over 80. So the elderly were clearly at the highest risk of mortality from this. And Cuomo's decision to send people who were, just for everyone listening, COVID positive seniors from the hospital into nursing homes. If you were trying to see the lethality of the epidemic, if you're trying to push the numbers up, that was a great strategy. If you're trying to save lives, it was obviously horrifically stupid. And now he's trying to blame the CDC. But what I think is so funny is, not funny, but, you know, so odd here, is that we've been told all along that the CDC is where the experts are. You got to listen to them. Wear a mask even when you're exercising. Now we're going to get told by Cuomo that the CDC is so stupid that this would be the guidance. Which is it? No one's responsible somehow.
I mean, I think that was the low point. He blamed Trump and the CDC. He said, that's right. Trump's CDC that made me do it. He's not taking any responsibility. But I think, and you see some of the people like Janice Dean, the smiley weather woman on Fox, just going after Trump because her in-laws, I mean, going after Cuomo because her in-laws died in nursing homes. And the other problem Cuomo has is the comparison. I mean, you look at DeSantis in Florida or Kemp in Georgia, and, you know, if you have any kind of fairness in you, if you're not a total partisan, you look at it and you say, wait a second, if Trump ordered the governors to put the elderly in the coronavirus positive patients in nursing homes, why didn't DeSantis do it? You know, why didn't Kemp do it? Why Cuomo? You know, why Murphy? It doesn't look good. I don't think we're hearing much talk. Maybe you are. I'm not hearing much talk of Cuomo for president anymore.
Oh, no, I think he's done. I mean, this is too... this is too clear. I mean, and you just laid out that was where I would want to take the conversation next, because that's clearly the other case study you have to look at, which is Florida. Florida, if you read a lot of people that think that they're smart in the media, and a lot of those who were citing the experts, endless tweets, you know, and this is how I feel like for normal people, they're like, Twitter, why is everyone, this is how everyone in the media is, you know, arguing and bickering with each other now all the time. Endless tweets about how Florida has blood. DeSantis specifically, obviously running the state of Florida, has blood on his hands. It's reckless what he's doing. DeSantis has put on a clinic in the best sort of way. I mean, DeSantis has taken the most effective path against the virus. It's not even close. And he was being told, or rather the media was telling him early on, that he was leading them into disaster and that he was killing people. And notice how the message, Jerry, hasn't changed, meaning that it's not, oh, we should learn from Florida. They just move on. I mean, this is why Rush Limbaugh's formulation of the drive-by media is so spot on. They did all this damage. It was completely false. And now that we see how you can actually save lives, which is smart, targeted policies meant to help the vulnerable, not locking us all, not putting us all on house arrest across the country, irrespective of age and risk. And there hasn't been that change. So, yeah, I think Cuomo, his presidential aspirations are probably done, but we're stuck with him here as governor because there's not going to be any real accountability.
Right. And we get to see him every night giggling, you know, with his little brother, another.
Bro Cuomo.
Another story of Fredo and his lockdown. But today or the other day, New York Post had the front page, you know, end the lockdown. I really felt like, and we talked to the author, David Marcus, it felt like it had an impact. I know New York and Boston, again, in some ways feel hopeless, but I in terms of the politicians, but I felt like the people are finally looking and saying, wait a second, it's not working. You know, it's, you know, let's try something different. Do you remember when we all initially 8 weeks, 10 weeks ago, we all initially thought we had to lock down because we didn't want the hospitals overrun. And New York was, you know, ground zero again. And we said, okay, fine. And then a week later, 2 weeks later, gradually people who were paying attention, like you, Buck Sexton, like me, said, this isn't working. Now we are 8 weeks later and more people are seeing it. But do you remember the day, the time that you realized that that we were taking the wrong strategy here?
Well, I remember that, you know, the debate. First of all, I was saying right after the 15 days, I was like, I don't care what anyone's telling me. We need to reopen. We need to get back to work as a country. This is crazy. And I was completely piled on by the libs all across the media that I wanted grandparents to die and everything, you know.
Right.
I mean, I tweeted something out about this that everybody was freaking out at me. And I'm like, look, I'm not saying don't protect older people and don't take basic precautions, but we can't keep doing this. So really, it was after the 15 days, because all you have to know is when someone changes, you know, it's just like in business or anything else. When someone changes the deal on you without any actual heads up, you got a problem. And they made a deal with the American people, which was 15 days to slow the spread. And then they just decided to change it out. Well, why didn't they start at 30? I mean, look, I could say this much. I think we could handle and stomach 30 days of the national lockdown. Everything beyond that to me has just been, you know, 2 weeks to me made sense. Even still, I'd say, given what the hospitals were looking at least in New York, I don't think it made sense everywhere. But in New York, you know, because I had friends who are docs in the ERs here, and they're saying, look, if this keeps going, we're not going to be able to treat any people who are coming up. Okay, 2 weeks, fine. 30 days, anything beyond 30 days is just egregious. So once we hit that 1 month mark, man, I was like, oh, this is turned into something else. As you know, it's political.
And you were one of the influencers, one of the leaders. I refer to the people on Twitter, you know, on the radio, on the podcast, like, you know, Alex Berenson, obviously. And
I have him on radio all the time. Yeah. Alex and I are always talking about this stuff. Yeah.
Right. And Dr. Katz and you and Mark Levin. And then you had Tucker come around and eventually there was a group of people that have a lot of influence that kind of woke people up. Now there's not a lot of liberals who are going to listen to Buck Sexton or, you know, Tucker Carlson, but if you read up, you know, just read up. That's what I tell people every day. Read up. You're going to say, wait a second. So kids aren't getting the virus. They're not given the virus. Why are kids locked away? And why are prisoners being let go? It just, nothing seemed to make sense anymore. And I'm with you. It was probably 3 weeks when I said, this just doesn't make any sense. And I feel like 8, 9, 10 weeks along, everybody should know that by now. But, you know, it's so political that no one's going to want to, just like they don't want to give Trump credit. They don't want to give DeSantis credit. They don't want to give Buck Sexton credit. So,
oh no. Oh no. Of course. I'm just a grandparent serial killer, according to the libs, because I think that America can't live hiding under its bed for the next 18 months. So I would also say though that, you know, the, we're all in this together. I have grown very tired of all the, as everyone has, I think, of the corporate messaging with the, it starts out with the piano mood music and it's just like showing, you know, flowing waves of grain and people in the heartland, people on the coasts, hand in hand, you know, we're, no, we're actually not all in this together. I mean, there's a study and I'm sure you have the same thing. It's probably people at the Cape. I don't know where your Beacon Hill folks, right? That's, I know a little Boston. I don't know where they retreat to. I certainly know where the rich New Yorkers retreat to. And, you know, it's out east, they call it in Long Island here on the southern shore of Long Island, the Hamptons. And 400,000 people, this is what I'm trying to get at, 400,000 people have gone to second homes or family homes outside of the New York City area. And that's just a microcosm. And, oh, and that doesn't include all the people that went to Florida and all the people, you know. The amount of people who are telling you from their mansion, whether it's in the Hamptons or in Malibu or out on the Cape or the Vineyard, I know where the fancy spots are, that are telling you, don't worry, shelter in place, everything is fine, shut up, peasant, go home. That's where we've also, I think, seen, we're not all in this together, actually. Some people are doing fine. Other people are in line at the food bank at 5 a.m. because they've got no money and no job because of the government.
And there were those seminal moments like Chris Cuomo's fake quarantine where people said, wait a second, or, you know, like the mayor of Chicago getting a haircut after demanding no one can get haircuts. And I think those woke some people up. I had a rule that I was came up with on my podcast, but if someone's telling you, you have to stay home, you can't go to work, you have to ask, you know, what are they giving up? What are they sacrificing? If they're not missing a paycheck, if they don't miss if their life's not affected at all, if their job's not affected at all, don't listen to them. I mean, it's as simple as that, in my opinion. Don't listen to them if they have no skin in the game.
Yeah, and if people want to stay home, I keep saying, isn't this easy, Jerry? Stay home. If you want to wait till a vaccine, God bless. Don't leave your house and try to figure things out as best you can in that regard. I'm not forcing anybody to go out and take risks they don't want to take. I mean, if you're under the age of 40 and you have a normal immune system, You're being overly cautious if you think you can't go outside with this thing. That's just the truth.
You literally
honestly under 60, but under 40, you're like, it's, you know, a lightning strike kind of a situation.
And I think the business owners, and we've talked to a bunch of them, I know you have too, kind of had an impact too, like this restaurateur up here in the North End. We talked to yesterday, Frank Mendoza, who said, I would rather die of the virus than lose my business. You know, he's built it. It's his life. He poured his whole life into it. And people are going, wait a sec. You know, if you're a bureaucrat at City Hall and you go to work, you know, 3 days a week, you're saying, what's he talking about? They don't understand that people's lives are invested in these small businesses and they would rather die than lose it. That is impactful.
I can assure you that if government employees for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts or the great state of New York weren't getting a paycheck or were even on half pay, this thing would have been over weeks ago. Because a lot of the people that are pushing for it, they don't care. They're getting money. The money's still coming in. Media is starting to wake up a little bit because the massive layoffs. It was furloughs, and now it's layoffs. They don't understand. My friend, you and I, we're basically in the marketing business, right? We do content, but it's content to sell product at some level. And so when products aren't selling, it's almost like libs don't know this, that, you know, the car commercials that are running on TV, if no one's selling cars, they're not running those commercials. They don't get that.
Today's episode is brought to you by our friends at Flagship Wealth. We're living in crazy economic times. You knew that. Job changes, job losses. You may have 401ks out there not being actively managed. Flagship has a free report called Managing Your Money in Retirement. Manage your Money in Retirement is a concise overview for new retirees presented in three steps. Ready? Define your retirement needs, emphasize the everyday expenses needed to maintain one standard of living. Add up to what you have covers both regular sources of income and assets, such as savings and home equity, and decide what to do, walks the reader through the planning process and suggests how to handle shortfalls. Get the free report by going to flagshipwealth.com/retirement or click the link in our show notes. That's flagshipwealth.com/retirement to learn more and get a copy of the free guide, Managing Your Money in Retirement. Securities offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA/SIPC. I keep looking for that, the first, you know, layoffs from the state or the city. And there was a story a couple of days ago about potential furloughs for some state employees. And I said, whoa, now it's getting real. Here we go. Some state employees might get furloughed. We need that, you know, we need that to wake some people up.
Yeah, we should. Shouldn't we, Jerry? Shouldn't we all be in it together? They keep telling us we're all in it together.
Right. That's what they told us.
I mean, people are getting crushed economically all over the place. Why should government employees not feel some of the economic pain? And look, I used to be a government employee, but reality is reality. We should all be in this together, right?
Yeah. And God knows they're taking a hit. The revenues, you know, tax revenues are way, way down. So, I mean, let's be honest. They got to do the same thing as the private sector. They got to make some cuts. I want to get to your job, your life in the public sector, because I always find this interesting when you talk about working for the CIA, being in Afghanistan or Iraq, and working for the NYPD. You're still young. You're really young. Why were you such a short timer? People in the CIA generally don't do 4 years and get out, do they?
There's a big drain, actually, of people that it's, I think it's usually in the intel community in general, sort of more community wide. A lot of people leave in the 5 to 7 year mark. That's actually pretty normal. And so I was there from 2005 to 2010, and it's to do what I was going to do, which was to, so, you know, the numbers are a little different because people will go, I was going to go get a graduate degree. And then a lot of people come back afterwards, or, you know, they take a year or two to do some additional education or training or even language skills, and then they go back in. Or, you know, they take a year or two thinking they're going to do that as I did. And then they get a taste of the private sector and they're like, I'm never going back. You know, it's like a taste of freedom. You're like, I'm not going back to the other side here. So, you know, the reasons that I left the agency, I actually didn't really plan to leave. It was, I was doing a year at the NYPD. I was still active CIA and I was working for the intelligence division at the NYPD. And I had been in Iraq and I'd been in Afghanistan on shorter tours. So I felt like I'd done some of that work. And just being in New York, I got the opportunity to go work in media. So I kind of fell out, or, you know, I stumbled out of the agency just by happenstance. It wasn't because I had, right before I took that NYPD job, I was looking to take a long-term assignment, you know, overseas that would have taken me off the grid for a whole bunch of time. So it just kind of happened in my case. But I'll tell you that, you know, why people do leave. A lot of people get, first of all, you know, you'll never be, if you work for the federal government, you'll never be poor, but you'll never have financial security. You know, you can't build wealth, really. So if you're a young guy and or gal and, you know, you want to try to be a little bit more in charge of your future that way, you got to accept that, you know, you're not ever racking up big cash. Or not even big cash. I mean, you're not, you know, you're stuck at what a well-paid state trooper makes in a lot of places, but which is good pay. I mean, look, I lived with it for years, but I'm just saying you're never going to be rich.
You can be like Dr. Bright, you know, make 285 grand and never go to work.
Well, I want to be, see, that's the thing. I want one of those government jobs where you get paid like 300K, not, you know, 60 or 70K, which is what I was making. And then you get to just sort of hang out. But, you know, the other side of it, man, is the bureaucracy. I'm telling you, it's just crushing. And when you're working in it every day and seeing what goes on, I went to the CIA to have influence for the, you know, influence in the fight against terrorism, to try to use my brain to the best of my ability to go kill those SOBs who took down the buildings in my home city and, you know, obviously hijacked the plane in Boston, attacked us in DC at the Pentagon, et cetera. And, you know, you go there and you get to do some of that work, but a lot of it is just, there's so much navel gazing. There's so much bureaucratic infighting. And look, it wears you down. So you're asking why people leave. They leave because a lot of the time they feel like they're not able to do what they signed up to do. And that's true across the federal government and the civil service. The civil service is, it's cushy, it's slow, and it's not impactful a lot of the time. That's what you have to get used to.
Did you know before most of us what a scam, what a hoax the whole Russian thing was? You've talked about it a lot, but, and it was eye-opening for some of us at some point. I mean, over the last 3 years, most of us realized it was, a scam, a scheme. Now we all know. But you knew early on, were these intelligence people? Did you work with weasels like Comey and McCabe and Strzok?
I knew Clapper when I was, you know, I knew him. He wouldn't know me, but I was, you know, I briefed him and interacted with him. I knew some of these guys when I was in. Yeah, they're really, they're institutionalists. It's even more than just partisan bent, although I think you'd consider them to be left of center in most of the cases. I mean, McCabe's a Democrat. I mean, Comey's a Comeyist, as I like to say. He just cares about James Comey. Nothing else really matters to him. But these guys, they become over time so indoctrinated in the institution itself that's what matters to them. You know, presidents come and go, but the agency is forever, or the bureau is forever, or whatever the case may be. And that's a really widespread mentality for these folks. So I wasn't surprised to see that they didn't like someone coming in who's talking about draining the swamp. And you got to remember, there was a real beef with Flynn too. People kind of leave this out. Flynn got removed as head of DIA. Part of the problem was that Flynn was a loud voice about how there was going to be the rise of ISIS in Syria and then Iraq. And this was a huge negative mark on the Obama administration's foreign policy record, which was a terrible foreign policy record anyway. I mean, I always ask people to just do the experiment of think about countries in 2009 that were hotspots or things were going on, and think about where they were over the course of the Obama administration to the end. And they basically all got worse. I mean, everything was worse than it was before. So, you know, the Obama administration was angry at Flynn, and they're looking to get even with him, which is why a lot of the stuff that we're seeing now, it all lines up. I mean, when you understand the motivation, it lines up. But the bureaucrat mentality, I mean, these people, the Milgram experiment, where, you electric shock somebody because that authority figure tells you to, and you keep doing it, and then they don't realize the person, or they don't care that the person's suffering up until they even die. A lot of bureaucrats will do that. I mean, whoever is above them in the chain of command and telling them to act in a certain way, they just go, okay, you know, I want to make sure I qualify for my OT and I have my health benefits and I go home at the end of the day and nothing else really matters. People don't like to hear that, but that's actually the truth of that's the institutional culture in these places. And as I say, process is the product and excellence is suspect. That is the truth of the federal bureaucracy.
You cover both these things. It's not just a political scandal. We know that, but I think it's the biggest media scandal of our lifetimes, Buck. And I'll tell you why. Is 3 years this thing went on. We heard from, most of the media, the mainstream media, certainly from CNNs and MSNBCs about Russia, and Trump's a Russian puppet and he's a Putin stooge and all this. We now don't know it's all made up, that they were lied to and they don't seem to mind. It's like, the same people who lied to them are still their sources, are still their colleagues. If someone lied to you consistently for 3 years, wouldn't you have a grudge? Wouldn't you hate their guts? Because I know I would.
Well, right. But that's because you have integrity, Jerry. If your purpose in life was merely just to take down the president, then it was useful when it was useful. I mean, and you're right. This is the question you'd ask. If you're a journalist, wouldn't you be upset at the sources that make you look like a total jackass because you reported on, this is a matter of record. They had to fire some journalists actually at CNN for essentially making up a story. I think it was about Scaramucci in a Russian bank. There's been tons of this though, but really the overall theory, the overall story of Russia collusion was one of the DNC working in concert with media allies and deep state actors in the FBI and the CIA to bring down a president. So the media had an active hand in this. So when you ask why aren't they upset at their sources, it's because they're not journalists, they're activists. And they were acting on behalf of the Democratic Party and trying to take down the president. And so it's really just the frustration that they have, I'd offer Jerry. You know, the reason that CNN and all they do look like they're a little ticked off these days, it's because it didn't work. That's the only problem. They don't care that it was a lie. They care that it didn't work.
That's such a good point. You think about it. They were in on it together. So they knew it was a lie. That's why they don't mind that Adam Schiff lied to their faces for 3 years. They still say, yeah, we tried. We gave it our best shot.
That's right.
It didn't work. And nobody pays a price. Not Schiff, not Nadler, not, Cuomo or Don Lemon. Nobody. It's incredible. Was CNN as nutty when you worked there as it is now?
That's actually a really interesting question. CNN, I tell it because people ask me, they say, how do you work there? And I will tell you, I have the excellent distinction of CNN actually wanted to keep me, which I thought was pretty outrageous. They offered to extend my contributor contract there. And I said no. And I had no TV job. I think I even had no job, period. I was between media gigs at the time. And I was like, I don't even care. I'm not taking a paycheck from these guys anymore. They went from being a liberal network that knew they had to at least have people from the right on so they could pretend to be balanced, to just being essentially a get Trump operation. Like they might as well just call themselves Media Matters / CNN. I mean, they're completely out of their minds. And it happened over the course of, you know, the Trump presidency. I was there for 2 years, 2015 and 2016, and mostly doing counterterrorism analysis in 2015. And then in 2016, so they were, you know, I was an expert, but I wasn't somebody that was political. So they were like, okay, whatever, this guy, he's fine. They didn't really pay that much attention to me, except when they, when there was a terrorist attack. But then when things got political in 2016 with Trump, oof, the tone of the anchors toward me on and off air, everything just changed, man. He broke them. I mean, psychologically, I mean, Trump hurt them emotionally in a way that they haven't recovered from yet. I mean, it's profound. You know, they just want to go cry themselves to sleep on the pillow.
Sometimes they do. Show me on the doll where the president hurt you, Don Lemon. Who was the worst? Give me a name.
The worst.
Like, ideologue
at CNN. Well, but the thing about Don Lemon is everyone knows what his deal right. is. I mean, he's an opinion guy. Let's just put it mildly. He's not particularly knowledgeable about anything. I actually think that either Cooper or Tapper in some ways the worst. Probably, well, Tapper's the worst because he's also a nasty guy. He's not a cool person at all. But he pretends to, like, he does all this stuff. Like, I love the troops so much. Oh, look at me, how much I love the troops. And it's like, right. you know, okay, your brand enhancement stuff couldn't be any more obvious, and it's gross. I've spoken to plenty of friends who are door kickers who are just like, yeah, I know the Tapper thing with, like, let me tell you how much I love the troops. And then the other thing is just pretending you're the bigger thing, that's a little more, I mean, that's a side note, to pretend you're an objective journalist when you work for a Democrat, hit operation like CNN. I mean, it's just pathetic. It's ridiculous. I mean, the guy might as well be drawing a paycheck from the DNC, but he gets all huffy and acts like he's doing real journalism. Cooper's gotten worse too in that regard. I mean, these guys, they're no different from MSNBC in terms of content and editorial lines, but they pretend to be. Why? And, you know, how do they make that distinction?
The Russian hoax, that's the upside to it. It kind of exposed them like nothing else ever exposed them. They've been exposed as, you know, an arm of the deep state or the DNC, and they don't seem to mind. So I think, you know, I'm always looking at the bright side. Two quick things before you go. I know you got to go. And they're related. These two things are related. You don't have a lot of debates on your show, but I think you're a good debater. And I think you hone those skills when you're outnumbered. And I can think of two places, two times in your life you've been outnumbered. One, you went to Amherst College, and I'm guessing those debates in the dorms were like 10-1. I went to UMass Amherst around the corner, and for me it was 20-1. You know, when I was there during the Reagan years, and it was fun. We had arguments in the dorms every night, and I was outnumbered every night, and I think that helped. You were at Amherst. It's almost as bad. It's kind of like, you know, the kids who couldn't get into UMass.
Amherst. Yeah, and it's as liberal, man. I mean, I can't imagine. There were people who were burning American flags 2 weeks after 9/11 on my campus. Now, I was told that they were actually Hampshire students who came to Amherst. Never was able to verify that, but that would make sense because they really are a bunch of lunatic commies
nutty. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So did you end up marrying a Smithy or a Holyoke girl, by the way, or did you,
I got up. I escaped and I didn't get brainwashed and I didn't get sucked in, and I had a good time. I had a great time. And we used to, you know, take the bus and, you know, pick up the Amherst College kids and, you know, occasionally stuff them in
give
the
us
locker,
a wedgie. But, yeah, of course. That's what we need.
The other place and time, and this was didn't quite last as long, but it was certainly more high profile. Bill Maher. When Bill Maher calls you to come on, are you hesitant? Do you know? Obviously, you're going to be ganged up on, but do you know who's going to be on with you and just how much they're going to be trying to bully you?
Yeah, I mean, so here's the thing. I mean, I know more than Bill and all of his guests, and I know that pretty much every time I'm going on. So, you know, I mean, without exception so far. So, you know, when you kind of can roll at it with that attitude, you're just like, okay, I understand you're going to have an audience, and it's not a fair fight at all. I mean, think of it like going into the Bill Maher show is a little bit like agreeing to play a football game and, you know, your quarterback can only use his weak hand or something. I mean, it's just, you're not getting a fair match, or, you know, the obvious one would be a boxing match where you can only fight with one arm, right? It's a bit like that. I don't know why I went to football, but it's a bit like that. And the reason I do it is because you can, first of all, you see how dishonest the liberal form of argument usually is, often is, where it's a lot of misdirection. And also the moment that they can throw comedy into something, you know, he'll make it's clown nose on, clown nose off. So he'll make an argument and I'll start to explain why it's wrong. And then he'll like drop an F-bomb and his audience goes, you know, and it's like, well, yeah, man, I can do this. I can do this too. But if we're having an exchange of ideas, the 1% of your audience that actually has a fair mind, which I think it's about, that's about 1%. They're fair-minded, probably. Maybe that might be too much. They see this and they go, huh, maybe there's something worthwhile here. Also, just to show that these people, you know, that conservatives, we can't be scared. One of my complaints is you have a lot of conservatives who won't go into enemy territory. I know the campus thing, the college campus thing, people are like, oh, you know, when you're like, I mean, I'm in my late 30s. When you go into a college campus, you do this professionally and you're like slapping around some emotionally disturbed 7 or 18-year-old who's coming at you with some argument that he read on the top of the Daily Coast or something. I mean, it's kind of entertaining, but I don't think it really does very much. I go because, you know, if you're a conservative, you can't have fear about your ideas, and it's a rigged game. And I know it's a rigged game, but, I think people should see what they've got to say and what I've got to say. That's right. Just my attitude.
You do well on, and you know what, without the audience, because of this, doing it remotely, without an audience, I like Bill Maher better because you remove all those morons. Yes. Just clap.
Yeah. The audience is really just meant to distract you as you're arguing with Bill, because right, they'll yell over you and hoot and holler and all this crap. And you're sitting there. And also if they'll interrupt a point on Bill's behalf for you, they'll do this when you say something that, you know, and it's just all meant to sort of throw you off your game. And then you have the other, you know, other panelists around you who are generally, I mean, the two times I've done it, there's been one panelist who was worth hearing from, who was intelligent, and the rest were all a complete. I mean, I just thought they had nothing to add. I don't dislike them as people, but they did not have intelligent arguments or anything worthwhile to say, including that bozo from the Washington Post. I don't remember his name. Dion, total zero, absolute lightweight, is writing books now about how far right wing conservatism is. And at the time I was like, dude, the head of the guy who's winning all of your primaries right now is a socialist. You're talking about how right wing we are? You're out of your mind.
Do you remember when the great Christopher Hitchens was on, the late and
greatest moment on the show, the middle finger?
The audience started hooting on him.
Of course.
I think that's what I would do. He just gave him, was it two middle fingers?
I think it was a single salute. It was a single salute, but I've read as many Hitchens books as I know that exist. I don't always agree with him on everything, but he was one of those figures where he just, the argument and the eloquence was always worthwhile. Even if you and he was wrong on some stuff, but sure, you know, in my view, but he was always worth hearing from. There are so few libs these days. They're all just playing to the dumbest common denominator in their audience all the time on the left. There's so few libs that are worth hearing from that have big clout. There exist. And there are libs that I'm friendly with, and I'll even do their shows. Very few though. And it's just a testament to how intellectually bankrupt that ideology has become.
I have a whole section, a Christopher Hitchens section over here in my bookshelf. And the last book, do you remember the last book, Mortality? He literally wrote it. And I recommend this to lots of people because there's nothing, I've never read anything like it, while he was dying. And it got to the point where it was incoherent because he was dying in his final minutes. He was typing. His wife took it. I think it was his wife, and cleaned it up and made a book out of it. But it is incredible. You're reading one of the great writers of our time dying. I mean, you've seen it in camera, but if you never read someone dying, it's fascinating. But anyway, one last thing: how was Bill Maher off the air? Was he like the CNN guy?
I will say, off the air, he's a good sport and a friendly guy, and appreciates. He called me the Sugar Ray Leonard of conservatism because I just keep coming and nothing phases me. So off the air, I will say he was a gentleman, and he is smart. I think his audience dumbs down the show. Bill Maher is a smart guy, and he does appreciate intelligence, even though the show is rigged.
And he had a great monologue about the lockdown. He agrees with you. He agrees with me. That was a refreshing moment. I mean, he hates Trump, and it kind of blinds him to everything else, but he's definitely on team liberty, not on team lockdown, which was good to see.
Absolutely. Hey, Jerry, man, thank you. And please, folks can download the Buck Sexton Show from the Jerry Callahan world, especially up in Boston. We need more Boston listeners here.
Absolutely. The Buck Sexton Show or the Buck Sexton Podcast, which is what I listen to. Check it out. That is Buck Sexton. Thanks for joining me, Buck. And we will do it again sometime.
Love to, Jerry. Thank you for having me.
Buck Sexton, interesting guy, an interesting biography, former CIA. I'd like to be former CIA. Former CIA, former NYPD, former Amherst College student, really good on, you know, intelligence stuff, but good on everything. He's smart and he's well-read and he's on Team Liberty. That's for sure. If you listen to him or check out his podcast or read his website, you know that he's on the right side of the lockdown, even though he's right in Midtown Manhattan, right in the belly of the beast. He knows this has gone on long enough. It's a good listen and a good read. And I can't imagine being the way, you know, being at Amherst College, which is even nuttier than UMass Amherst, and being a right winger. But I'm not sure, by the way, I'm not sure if I would go on Bill Maher if I were invited. I don't think I could control myself. Buck's kind of level-headed and well-spoken. I think I'd lose it having all these loons yell at me and the crowd hoot on me for, you know, doubting climate change, which is generally one of their themes. I think I'd go full Christopher Hitchens and give him the double bird when they started doing that. But thanks to Buck Sexton, and thanks to everyone for listening and for checking us out on our website, thejerrycallahanpodcast.com. Thanks to Cullinane. I'm Jerry Callahan. This is the Jerry Callahan Podcast. We'll talk to you again. Talk to you again soon.
Why am I stopping? No one else stops.
Can I go home?
The Jerry Callahan Podcast.